Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to a special Executive Branch Review Week edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleforum conference call as today, April 29th, 2020, we host a Teleforum entitled Federalism, COVID-19, and the Administrative State. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast and will likely be transcribed. It's also open to the public and open to the press. We're very pleased to welcome back, really in a series of their own, two returning guests. We're going to hear from each of them. They'll have a lot of back and forth, questions and back and forth between the two of them. But as always, ultimately, we'll turn to the audience for your questions. So please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. Professor John C. Yu is the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley School of Law. He's also the author of several books, including the upcoming book, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. That is due out in July 28th this year, so about 3 months from today almost. But you can pre-order it now on Amazon. It, again, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. We'll also be joined, of course, by John Malcolm. He's Vice President, Institute for Constitutional Government, and Director of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and Senior Legal Fellow, all at the Heritage Foundation. With that, gentlemen, welcome. I'll turn it over to John Yu.
Dean, thanks a lot, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having us back. And I'm glad we could be part of the Executive Branch review sessions. I understand they've been great attendance and participation, and I hope we can continue that in today's session. And it's also great to be back with my partner in crime, John Malcolm, and I think this must be the seventh or eighth series in the series on executive power. I think we started back more than a year ago talking about this. Seems like ancient history, the Mueller report. And then there's this thing called impeachment, and now the pandemic. And
a virus, thing is, right.
Yeah, and one thing that's consistent is the presidential power and President Trump throughout all of this. So why don't we just get right into it and talk about, I think, the issue involving presidential power, Congress, the states that has been on a lot of people's minds has been, does the president have the authority to both either lock down or reopen the economy? John, why don't you start? What do you think?
Well, I was thinking as Dean was making this announcement that your book coming out about the president and you're trying to get constitutional authority couldn't very well timed. You know, I think there's sort of a different analysis in terms of locking things down and opening things up. So, you know, as a general matter, the president, through acts of Congress or through his inherent authority, has a lot of control over foreign travel and interstate travel. So, you know, he's using that in part to also stop immigration. We can talk about that that too. But he has certainly slowed foreign travel to a crawl, and of course, he has the authority to stop people whom he suspects may have coronavirus and order them to be quarantined. He really has plenary authority there. He has not stopped anybody from traveling interstate, but a lot of governors have done that. You know, he hasn't yet tried to stop commerce flowing interstate because of supply lines somehow being infected with coronavirus, but he would certainly have some authority to do that. Most of the locking down that has been going on has been with guidance, obviously, from the CDC, Drs. Fauci and Birx, but it's been being done by the governors. And I think at first people were understanding of this and largely compliant. There were a few mega churches that wanted to continue to hold meetings and things that caused a bit of a problem. But the locking down was mostly being done by the governors. Now, as the virus is starting, we're past peak and it's starting to recede, hopefully permanently, but who knows? the pressure is going in the other direction about opening up the economy. And again, I think the governors control a lot of that, but not exclusively. So one thing I thought was really, really interesting. So Attorney General Bill Barr on Monday put out a memo that he sent around to all 94 of his U.S. attorneys talking about, you know, being on the lookout for allegations that governors and other state and local authorities have gone too far in terms of impinging on people's civil liberties and constitutional rights. And one of the things that he said was not only about legal restrictions that discriminate against religious institutions or religious believers, and not only about instances in which disfavored speech is somehow being squelched, but he also highlighted, you know, governors and state and local officials who engage in, quote, undue interference with the national economy, which surprised me, sort of a clear reference to the dormant commerce clause. And, you know, we will see whether the Department of Justice takes action there. So I think the president clearly would have the authority, for instance, to order the military, federal officials to go back to work. I don't think governors could interfere with that at all. You know, there's the Supremacy Clause, other precedent going all the way back to McCulloch versus Maryland and other cases like Geyer versus America Honda Motor Company that says that state officials can't interfere with federal officials implementing federal policy. Beyond that, it's a little tougher to tell. So there's the Defense Production Act. Some people like David Rivkin have argued that this gives the president more authority. And I'll go this far. The findings, that the congressional findings at the beginning of the Defense Production Act talk about the need to keep critical infrastructure supply lines open in response to a natural or man-caused disaster. A virus could certainly be a natural disaster. And it also talks about foreign threats to the security of the United States. A little strange to think of a virus as a foreign threat, but it's certainly a virus that emanated overseas. So it sort of points in the direction of the president being able to use the Defense Production Act to open up the economy, at least when it comes to critical infrastructure. But one, then it becomes a question of how broad do you go in terms of defining domestic critical infrastructure? And also, that's the findings that lead to the Defense Production Act, but there's nothing in the Defense Production Act itself that says that once a governor has ordered a business closed, the federal government can order it that it be opened. So we'll see.
Huh. I think it's interesting. I would break it down similarly, although I might have some differences on a few of the finer points. So first with the economic lockdown and reopening, I quite agree that the president has the authority to do something to affect a lockdown, control over entry over the borders, travel across the borders. Again, this is not the president's constitutional authority. This is a power that Congress has given through delegation in a statute. The foreign travel will be over the would be through the Immigration Naturalization Act. And, President Trump has halted temporarily much immigration into the United States. As you said, John, interstate travel hasn't been blocked. The president's authority there would come from the law, the federal regulatory authority over airlines, over the trains. I'm not really sure there's any for highways. But then the broader powers in the Public Health Services Act, which gives the HHS the power to detain and stop the movement of people across state borders or about to cross into across state borders who may, it says the phrase is, may reasonably be believed to have the communicable disease. The interesting thing is whether that power could be converted into, as you say, John, a kind of quarantine of a state. Could President Trump have limited movement into and out of New York City based on that? Could you say this power to reason, you know, to block people, individuals reasonably thought to have a disease, convert into just a sort of general quarantine, including the 80 or 90% of people who don't, we know don't have the disease. That would be an interesting question. But the primary, I think, answer in terms of the shutdown and the reopening is that the states still have the police power, that it is the state governments that have the primary responsibility for public health and safety. And they have control, general regulatory control over all individuals and businesses within their borders. And they primarily are the ones who can control the intrastate movement necessary to have these shelter-in-place orders that almost all states in the country have. It's interesting. You could say this is a separation of powers issue because the interesting question is, could Congress have given the president power to lock down and reopen businesses? And at least a separation of powers question, I think we can agree that the Congress hasn't. Now, there is no statute, as far as I'm aware, that would go as far as, say, Gonzales versus Reich, which allows the federal government to prosecute all sales of illicit drugs, even the ones that are done four blocks from my office here in Berkeley, where someone grew the marijuana and gave it to a neighbor. That was within the Commerce Clause power. Or, say, the Title VII cases, which said that the businesses, just because they buy or sell into interstate commerce, or they buy and sell to people who've traveled in interstate commerce, come within the Commerce Clause, in cases like Katzenbach and so on. And the famous Ollie's Trolley's Barbecue case, which is a favorite of mine. But it's a separation of powers issue, because even if we could play with the outer extent of the Commerce Clause and ask how far it can go before it infringes on state police power, Congress has not chosen to give President Trump or any president that power. Let me just talk about, again, what powers are available. And before we talk about the individual rights issues, which you raised, which I think are interesting, prompted by the Barr memo to the Justice Department to look out for cases of individual rights infringements. I agree. The Defense Production Act, I think that's a real stretch. I can't see, if you look at the statute, how that would allow the president to order the opening of the businesses that we're talking about here that are under the jurisdiction of the state, small businesses, restaurants, movie theaters, entertainment, sports, things like this. You say the Defense Production Act, the text there has very broad findings, but then Congress was pretty careful in the powers it delegated to the president, and they're primarily designed, as the president has used it so far, primarily designed to allow the federal government to force private businesses to prioritize defense needs. So for example, you needed more tests, or I think swabs, or even the order yesterday to keep the meat production open. That's really what the defense production is. There are certain goods that the national defense requires. The Defense Production Act allows the president to come in, again, at Congress's authority, to come in and say you have to fulfill the defense needs first over and above any existing contracts you have. I don't see how, with all respect to our friend David Ritkin, I don't see how that converts into this sort of general power to reopen. Maybe, I don't even know if it allows for you to say, the president say, the Defense Production Act allows me to order all businesses that cross state lines to just do what they do. It seems to me you have to have some kind of federal requisition of some kind of defense-related need that has to be produced. So I don't see how, for example, you can use the Defense Production Act to say, Carnival Cruise Line, start holding your cruises again and make sure all the singers and dancers and blackjack dealers are back. Now, I think that might be an individual rights issue on my part as somebody who likes to gamble. But I don't think the Defense Production Act gets you there. You could say the other area that hasn't really been explored by Trump, which, you could talk about, what if Trump started using the spending power to try to get states to reopen earlier than the governors want? One of the things that's going on here is that the federal government, through the Stafford Act, $40 billion, you declare national emergency, you can start sending just money to support disaster relief. That seems like a minuscule drop in the bucket compared to the huge stimulus programs that have been passed in the last two go-rounds, the CARES Act and then the recent act that just refilled the coffers at the CARES Act. Imagine, what if the president starts saying, well, I'm going to be conscious of what states are doing with their reopenings, and I'm going to start funneling all of this $1 trillion to the states based on whether they're being cooperative with federal priorities. That would be really interesting. That would raise the issue of, you know, the spending power being used in a way that eventually becomes coercive because too much money is at stake, as the Supreme Court went up for remind us when it struck down part of the Obamacare Act. That's something the federal government, as far as I know, the White House has not proposed to do yet, but that might be its greatest tool, as it often is in domestic affairs, is the spending clause.
So I agree with, I agree with pretty much everything you just said, although I think that it would be coercive if they were taking away grants that had been previously made by changing the conditions of the grants. But if they're all of a sudden talking about new money, or you're talking about, you know, you agree with me, you get ventilators. You don't agree with me, you don't get ventilators. He can certainly use the bully pulpit. The president uses the bully pulpit all the time. And I don't think there's a constitutional problem with any of that at all. There may be a political problem, but, you know, this president courts political problems often. I think you're right. I agree with you that I don't think the Defense Production Act gets in there. And I also think that Congress could, if it wanted to, you know, pass a law that would require all of these businesses to open it up. I mean, you know, the Commerce Clause has done away with, you know, certainly through Gonzalez versus Raich and Wickard versus Filburn, has done away with any distinction between interstate commerce and for all intents and purposes, intrastate commerce. The only line that's been drawn is that they can't force somebody to engage in commerce in order to regulate it. That was NFIB versus Sebelius. But here, these are commercial businesses that are, you know, that they're clearly engaging in commerce. But Congress hasn't done that. And I don't think they're going to. There is one authority that I forgot to mention that the president could have done, not with respect so much to open up businesses, but to lock down a state. There is a regulation in Title 42 that deals specifically with regulations to control communicable diseases. And it does say that the Surgeon General, with the approval of the Secretary of HHS, is authorized to make and enforce such regulations as in his judgment are necessary to prevent the introduction, transmission, or spread of communicable diseases from foreign countries into the states or possessions, or from one state or possession into any other state or possession, the possessions, of course, being Indian territories. See, this is an authority that's there, so a president, I think, could direct Alex Azar to do this, but he hasn't done it, and I don't think at this point he's going to do it.
Yeah, that's an interesting question of statutory interpretation, because that same provision, that this provision you cited is part of the Public Health Services Act, and then it has this later provision, the one I cited about, and that regulation, that power includes the power to block people from moving back and forth. It's an interesting question whether you could then say, I think courts would defer in the middle of an emergency and not block any kind of quarantine order based on that reading that you just gave. That's very interesting. I really, the spending power is just, I don't know if it's something Trump has thought of or they thought they can't get away with. As you know, as you're quite right, the Sebelius case and Obamacare was about taking away money that was already, and this is right, Medicare, Medicaid grants that states were already reliant on. But remember, the overall constitutional test is it coercive? So the interesting thing is, what if the president said, okay, I've got $1 trillion. Basically, the Congress has shoveled the money out as fast as possible. There's very few conditions on it. What if I just said, well, those states that are going to open early, they're going to need the money more because they might have a resurgence of the virus. So I'm going to say the money will go more than the per capita average to Florida, Texas. You know, the states that are going to open up early, I'm going to send the money to
or your swing states.
Like, yeah, exactly. California, New York, yeah, you're not going to get that much money because you don't need it. You're all locked down anyway. So what do you need the money for? You can't reopen, right? And blame it on the state governors. I just think it's an interesting thing I think could you know, it's whether the court, this is the next step after Sebelius, could say the withholding of new money is sufficiently coercive in the way, just as taking away old money would be coercive. But let me ask you one, let's move to the other topic you raised, which I think is really interesting. Also, you see reference this Barr memo. Do you think, John, that the states could be challenged on lockdown orders? And there's two cases going forward now. There's one in Pennsylvania, a bunch of cases in California. The Pennsylvania case is already at the Supreme Court on cert, petition for cert. That challenges primarily the lockdowns as a violation of due process and equal protection because the lockdowns are arbitrary and capricious. The cases in California, most of them are about free speech for protesters, Second Amendment for gun sales, First Amendment for people who want to go to church. What do you think about these kinds of lawsuits and their chances for success?
Well, I think if they are, in fact, making arbitrary distinctions, then there may be a basis to challenge. However, it's tough to prove that these are going to be arbitrary distinctions. So, for instance, people are able to go take out in restaurants or to go to pharmacies or to go to grocery stores because they got to eat. They've got to get their medication or doctor's appointments because, you know, they have a health reason. There's going to be some reason for making these distinctions. So I think those lawsuits are going to be tough. Doesn't mean, you know, look, some of these distinctions are really stupid. I mean, there are some governors that will, you know, prevent people from going fishing when they're by themselves in the middle of a lake, or prevent a father and son or father and daughter, I'm not meaning to be sexist, from having a catch with their kid and then, you know, in an empty park. These are stupid distinctions, but proving that they're arbitrary, unless it's something like that, or will be difficult. I do think, though, that when you are talking about touching upon, you know, a clear constitutional right like freedom of free exercise of your religion, that then the calculus will shift. Not so much that megachurch is going to be allowed to open up to everybody, but you know, you're seeing these cases, for instance, in these drive-by church services. First opinion was issued by Justin Walker, district court judge in North Carolina, who's Trump's nominee to the D.C. Circuit. But you're getting others, like in Michigan, where these sorts of challenges, where you're going to say, you know, you can't, if we're going to comply with safety restrictions, therefore you, the government, you may have a compelling interest in preventing the spread of this disease, but you have less restrictive alternatives to meet that compelling interest that do not interfere with our ability to exercise our religion. So there it's less about arbitrary power than it is being used in a discriminatory manner, or it's an attempt to stop activity that is subject to strict scrutiny because it has a special constitutional protection. Those lawsuits, I think, may very well start to, you know, see some success. But the idea of, you know, gee, we're tired of being inside, and therefore we'd like to gather in a large group so that we can let you know how unhappy we are, I think those types of lawsuits are going to have a more difficult time.
I agree. I think the people who are claiming straight out arbitrary and capriciousness, as we know, the court hasn't held economic regulation to be arbitrary and capricious since the New Deal revolution, except for the single case of gay marriage. So it's hard to see, even though I think there are ways to show that these decisions are arbitrary and capricious, like, you know, why are golf courses closed or open, right, compared to other things. But courts, I think, especially in emergency, can be pretty deferential. I agree with you. I think the better lawsuits are ones where you've already got a clear constitutional right and you can offer this is a narrow tailoring test, right? You can offer less restrictive policies the government should obey that would allow you to still exercise your religion and the state to meet its goals. So as you say, having churches where people sit 6 feet apart in the pew or stay in their cars, or notably California just announced it will not allow any protests and demonstrations at all on the state capitol grounds. I want to think that if the protesters say we'll wear masks and gloves and stand 6 feet apart. You know, that just sounds like a protest in California anyway. But even if, you know, you can say we're obeying, you know, the social distancing guidelines, exactly the same ones, perhaps even better than what's going on in Costco's and Walmart around the state. How can the state get away with saying no protests or demonstrations? Seems like almost like a Holosco hypothetical for an unconstitutional state regulation of speech. Here, there was a little interest. Let me this will be the last thing to talk about because we're almost at the end of our half hour. Let me ask you this interesting quirk in one of the cases. Actually, there are cases both in California and Pennsylvania both raise this issue, which is people who are running for office are challenging the lockdowns because the lockdowns apply to campaign offices. I love this case. It's part of the Pennsylvania case. The challenger's name, I love this, is Danny DeVito. I didn't know Danny DeVito moved to Pennsylvania and was running my home state and running for the state legislature. Yeah. He ought to win just so Danny DeVito is in the state legislature. I assume it's another Danny DeVito. Anyway, so Mr. DeVito says that the lockdowns infringe his right of assembly and petition and free speech because he's running for office. He's a major party nominee. Whereas the incumbent, since I believe it's a she is already a state legislator. Her office is open. And so the lockdowns give an inherent political advantage to incumbents. And there's another case out here in California that makes the same claim. The courts, I think, so far have rejected it at the trial levels and in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. What do you think of that?
Well, that's really interesting. I would have thought that being an incumbent these days that was enforcing a lockdown when it's becoming at a time when it is now starting to become politically unpopular would be a danger to their incumbency. Perhaps if they can keep their opponents under wraps so that they're doing Biden-esque interviews from their living room, that it might be an incumbency protection measure.
They have to stay open so they can take constituent complaints about the lockdown. Like that's how government works.
You know, I still think that for the reasons that you said, I mean, at the time of a crisis in which nobody really knows, you know, how many people have had this virus, what the likelihood of it coming back are going to be, I just think they're going to be so unduly deferential. Or they're going to be deferential, whether it's unduly or not, will leave to others to decide. They're going to be very, very deferential of the decisions of these public health officials. I mean, I know that there are judges who occasionally leap in and say, I can do a better job legislating than you can, or I'm going, you know, like the Sixth Circuit has just decided to take over public schools to provide basic minimum guarantees of, you know, education. They think they can do a better job than policymakers. I don't know too many judges yet who think they're better than you know, doctors and people who specialize in the spread of viruses. And I think they're going to tread extra carefully there.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, one thing is I'm sure the politicians say, well, my campaign office is closed, but, you know, my office to serve the constituents can remain open, and that's not content-based restrictions or anything. But the court, you know, they wanted to make sure campaigns are free and fair and open. And you would have thought a sensible state would have at least allowed an exception for what's an essential service, which is, you know, running for a political office. So I think it's an interesting challenge. I'm not sure how the courts will come out, but I agree with you. During the midst of the pandemic, it's unlikely, the courts are unlikely to step in. But, you know, as the curve is flattening and the infection rates are going down, mortality rates are going down, you're going to see a lot more of these challenges. They're important signals. It's interesting. It's a challenge to executive power at the state level. Not executive power. I'll turn over to Dean for questions. The interesting thing is you have the use of the executive here through the Barr memo and the Justice Department. The federal executive is trying to use his powers to constrain the powers of state executives, which is an interesting dynamic. Often you see them in cooperation, and here you see them in conflict.
Well, I think that the Barr memo, it's hard to to tell just how much on the offensive they're going to go. I think what they're very clearly doing is saying, we're going to see what kind of lawsuits get filed, and we will, if we think it's appropriate, file notices of interest and attempt to intervene in those cases. So they'll take a back seat until others proceed. And I think in terms of these other lawsuits, look, with now we're starting to get widespread testing. We're starting to figure out that there have been, you know, way more people have been exposed to this virus than before. And so while it's, you know, 50,000 more people have died now from this virus in the last 4 months than died in the entirety of the Vietnam War. So I'm not meaning to minimize this, but in terms of the numbers of people who have actually been exposed to this virus who are dying, the numbers are much lower than at least than we thought even a week or two ago. And so as we get more and more information, you know, the calculus may change, both in terms of how politicians view this and also how courts view this.
Great. So with that, let's turn it over to Dean. And we thanks a lot for the time, and we welcome the questions and comments from people who've called in. Dean, take it away.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. That was a great opening round of remarks there. We've got, it looks like we're approaching a couple hundred callers. Let's go right to the floor. And while we're waiting to see who rings in here, I'll ask, in some of these lawsuits, do you see the court ever going behind stated reasons for government actions as they did in the census case, where there was a purported reason by the administration to do something, and the court, I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, sort of came to the conclusion that the administration had other reasons for doing what it's doing. It's the first time I'm aware, and that was an Administrative Procedure Act agency question, but do you see anything like that on the horizon?
So that's interesting. So they sort of flipped. I agree with you that they did that in the census citizenship question. And it was John Roberts, he wrote the Trump versus Hawaii, the travel ban case, in which he basically said, well, as long as there's a facially legitimate reason for doing this, we're not going to look behind the executive branch's quote unquote true motive. And he flipped in the census case. I don't know is the answer to the question, but I suspect that there you might start to see a difference on who is the executive. If you are questioning governors' reasons for doing things, courts may be a little bit less deferential than if it's the president doing something, but it's a very interesting question.
It is very interesting. We maybe didn't spend as much time and attention to the Administrative Procedure Act element of things or administrative law aspect. You know, generally, the court doesn't look at motivation or pretext when it reviews administrative action. It certainly, as John just mentioned, doesn't when it comes to executive orders, and seems, I think, less likely when it comes to emergencies because of the, you know, the press of time and resources. Not even clear to me some of the things that are being done would fall subject to the Administrative Procedure Act, things like declaration of a national emergency. You know, there's this interesting question, actually, that it's really just sort of been overlooked in all this, which is kind of an Administrative Procedure Act issue. I mean, not maybe an administrative law issue, which is, as you may know, these declarations of emergency trigger the Stafford Act. Stafford Act talks about two kinds. One is for natural disasters, and it gives lists, examples which are like hurricanes and earthquakes, things like that. And then emergencies for which lie within the federal government's powers. And so there you think of like foreign affairs and so on. There's a plausible argument that the pandemic falls in between the cracks there. And that you would say, well, it's not a natural disaster of the kind that statute talks about, but it's also not one of those, you know, specific federal government only issues. But I think, again, courts are just going to defer to that. Even though I think Congress, when they wrote the Stafford Act, really wasn't thinking about pandemics. That kind of case would raise all those issues. Chevron deference would be the most obvious one, because you do have an ambiguity in the statute here, and the executive branch, not just this one, but several executive branches have interpreted it to allow, you know, triggering of a national emergency for a pandemic. But actually, the statute doesn't obviously include it.
Your point's an interesting one. Since it opened the floodgates of money to every state, since there's now been a national emergency declared to every state, no one was about to complain about that that potential crack in the law. Dean, we got any questions?
Go ahead, caller.
Nope. It's Mike Doherty. How are you guys? All right. So I'm down here in Destin, Florida, lots of NNDC. And so I have a lot of rental properties. Again, the way I've observed the last month and a half, it's like, take my civil rights, please. And if you don't take them, then you're a terrible person. There's that whole crowd of that. And then you see in the Panhandle, which is a very conservative Republican red part of Florida, you have this muscle from not the government, but from the police officers and these working level people and managers of buildings that have said, you seriously, the HOA of one building said you can't have guests in your condo, you can't go on your private beach. And this is moving so fast. It's the speed of the unknown is what concerns me. And I'd like your comment on this, is that we just didn't know. And we use the fact that we didn't know as an excuse to just strip everything. And now, and how is that going to work out in a judicial ruling about, well, if you don't know, you got worst case scenario. And it's kind of like the day after 9/11, you know, the hell of civil rights. So, and now I see it coming back a little bit, and we have more time to see that this isn't as extreme as we thought. But I'm not seeing anyone wanting us to, you know, let anyone back in the business. So that excuse that's being used out of non-government people is, and there's no law that's really worth anything. No one's going to push back. And what are you going to do? Sue your HOA board with that kind of money. So that's my, I hope in there's a question about your general opinions about this whole, you know, flying so fast, we work in worst case scenario and strip your rights thing.
So your question raises a lot of different questions or sub questions, Mike. So one is, I think that people were willing to go along with this, at least at the beginning, because there were incredible unknowns. I mean, again, we've had more people die in the last 4 months than in the entirety of the Vietnam War. But originally, we were thinking this was going to be a minimum, if you'll recall, a minimum of 150,000 people, and quite possibly as high as 2.3 million people. And I think that under those circumstances, people were prepared to say, all right, extraordinary, you know, these are extraordinary times, and desperate times call for desperate measures. And people were willing to go along with it because they literally, you know, the thing we fear the most in, as a general matter, is death. And everybody was afraid of dying. That at moment, at least for the moment, and we'll see what happens in the fall and winter, is starting to recede, and people are less tolerant and more itchy to, you know, get out of their homes. With respect to the police enforcement of these powers, I mean, everybody now is hearing examples of just sheer stupidity of law enforcement officers who, granted, have a very tough job under the best of circumstances, and these not under the best of circumstances, but law enforcement officers using horrendously bad judgment. And instead of trying to calm people's nerves by reasoning with them, perhaps giving them a warning, telling them to move along, are handcuffing people, arresting people, fining people, and all they're doing is inflaming people's concerns and tensions and exacerbating what is already a very, very bad situation. What's unclear to me, you raised 9/11, and it is certainly true that after 9/11, people's views about security and the inconveniences and in some cases downright curtailments of civil liberties has changed. So, you know, we put up with a lot more cameras, and we have invasive searches by TSA when we go to the airport. And, you know, there's much more difficult to enter into a federal building. And we've somehow become acclimated to that. And it's going to be very interesting to me to see how things change in terms of whether we become more acclimated to these sorts of invasive procedures after this crisis? And there's still more coming. I mean, you're getting Apple and Google are now developing things like contact tracing technologies. How's that going to be deployed? And how's that going to change the calculus about what we're willing to put up with? It raises all kinds of interesting questions. It's very unclear what's going to happen there.
I think I don't see a lot of hope in using the law to generally attack the lockdowns, although they, you know, those intrusive things we see on individual movement in a century, only because just the federal courts have given up trying to review economic regulation or social regulation. That's why I think the real claims that you could bring would really have to be rooted in the individual constitutional rights. You know, the most obvious ones here would be a takings clause, if the government is, you know, seizing property or using it, or prohibiting use of the property so much that there's just no economic value to it. You know, this is sort of like the Lucas takings case, although, you know, the Lake Tahoe case, the court said it was willing to tolerate temporary restrictions on property that might deprive much value for the property. I think that the lockdowns will be challenged, and I think that the lawsuits actually provide this broader political purpose, which is that even if there is no judicial review over these things, the sheer irrationality, and I think that's as John's referring to this, the irrationality of the distinctions of what's essential and non-essential, the irrationality of enforcement, where you're seeing, for example, a guy in Colorado being arrested for playing t-ball in a park with his daughter. These lawsuits are going to be good at identifying these irrationalities and building political opposition to them and demands that they be overturned. But I'm not that hope. Now, that's just federal law. States, as you know, are free to adopt much broader protections for individual rights. And I think here in California, actually, you're seeing, at least at the trial level, several courts are more open to blocking some of these lockdown orders because they, for example, they close down gun stores, but they allow Costco and Walmart to be open. That's the kind of thing I think where you will see much more development and protection of individual rights will be at the state level and state courts.
We've got five questions. Go ahead, John.
Two things. One is with respect to takings. I mean, you're seeing all of these temporary non-eviction orders or temporary rent freezes, and the whole business of essential businesses. So, in some places, gun stores or abortion clinics are closed down, and in others, medical marijuana facilities are allowed to stay open. I mean, I don't know how these things are going to get tested in court, but there are all sorts of interesting legal questions there too.
How do we keep in mind, or should we keep in mind, that for every bad interaction we're hearing about on the web, whether it's from the police or from a landlord or whatever the case might be, or from a government official, a lot of people are getting it right? In other words, for every bad interaction with the police officer, there's probably hundreds or thousands of instances where the police don't escalate things and they just act in a way everybody would want them to. And that's probably true of landlords. It's probably true of a lot of other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit, the analogy is when it comes to media is when it bleeds, it leads. And so people, you know, want to highlight the bad stuff. But it is certainly true that we have lots of first responders who are doing unbelievable work and police officers who are helping people who are sick to go to hospitals or bringing food to people who are infirmed and in their homes. And, you know, there are stories out there like that, but, you know, that's not what the media tends to harp on.
Good enough. We've got six questions now in the queue, so let's roll on. We've got about 15 minutes left, so I'll ask our callers to be as concise as possible. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, this is Michael Rossman with the Center for Individual Rights. I'm a big fan of the John and John show from way, way back.
Thanks, Michael.
And my question is this. John Malcolm mentioned a statute, of which I was unaware, that apparently allows the Surgeon General to issue orders to prevent the spread of disease from one state into another. And I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, that you were suggesting that perhaps the Surgeon General could issue an order that would essentially quarantine individuals pursuant to that statute. And my question is this. If Congress actually has that authority, why doesn't it have the authority to say pass general criminal laws on the ground that criminals might go from one state into another, and we need to lock them down to make sure that they don't.
Well, so by the way, if anyone is interested in checking it, the law I was referencing is 42 U.S.C. Section 264, and it would enable the Surgeon General to prevent people from traveling from one state to another, from Native American territory into a state. I don't think that they could use it to say you have to be locked down in your particular home, but they could certainly prohibit interstate travel. And if they prohibited interstate travel, they could effectively lock down a state. Now, with respect to a criminal travel.
I had understood that perhaps you were suggesting he could actually order someone to stay in their home as opposed to stay within their state.
No, I think I was talking about a governor could order somebody to stay in their home.
Yeah, right.
The president,
that was the distinction.
He could prevent interstate. He could prevent interstate travel.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
I think it's an interesting statute because this Section 264, it's part of the Public Health Services Act, and it's the act is Section 361. And John quoted 361 Section A, which has this language about just issuing a regulation that blocks the spread of this disease from abroad or between states. And it's interesting, 361D, which is just three subsections after, says regulations may provide for the apprehension and examination of any individual reasonably believed to be infected with a communicable disease when they're about to move from a state. So the interesting question would be, is any regulation about quarantining limited to what you're talking about in this D, which is about individuals who are reasonably believed to be infected? Or is that just an example? And 361A gives a broader power to just block all travel out of, say, New York City, whether you as an individual are infected or not. So, the individual liberties person would say, it doesn't make sense to have D in there at all unless it was limiting, because otherwise A by itself would just already have included that power. Why is D in there unless it was meant to narrow the regulatory power? The D only talks about, this is injury, right? Talks about, sounds like there has to be some kind of proof that the individual you're blocking might be infected. And it may not be the case just saying coming out of New York City is itself reasonable to believe you might be infected. In fact, right, even if the worst case scenarios are true, it sounds like at least 70% of people leaving New York City would not be infected. So this goes to executive power. It goes to Dean's first question, because that would be a question of, right, administrative law, how much deference the courts would give to the president saying, well, I'm going to read this ambiguous statute to give me that power. And I don't have to go through the APA. We're in an emergency. I'm just making this emergency declaration triggering the Public Health Services Act. I don't think the APA applies in emergency. Good luck in court.
Although if you read it your way, you'd have to have 100% testing at the entry of and immediate results, which would be completely impractical because of the limits on testing and the fact that people can be completely asymptomatic and still have the disorder. So I again think courts would be differential, but it's an interesting question.
I do too. I do. I agree. I think courts would be differential also. Yeah.
We've got five questions and a hard stop at 3:30 Eastern, so I don't think we're going to get to all of them, but we will soldier on now. Caller from 415, go ahead.
Hello, this is Joe Rosanello. I'm in Phoenix right now, and I appreciate your reference to golf, because normally I wouldn't be listening to you. I'd be out playing golf, but at 100 degrees, we don't even need lockdown laws in order to stay off the golf course at 100. I enjoyed your comments. John, I enjoy you almost as much as I enjoy seeing our friend Deborah Saunders at the White House press briefings. My question is this. I think that it's probably true. I think we'd all admit that over the course of time, these fine lines of separation of power that we make and have respect kind of break down in times of crisis, whether it's the sedition laws or the suspension of habeas corpus or the internment of the Japanese or Truman's nationalization of the steel industry, whatever. It's when we have the crisis that we sort of scramble. And I'm looking specifically and thinking specifically of this police power issue that Trump got himself twisted up in. And assuming that the police powers are reserved to the states, and there's not much doubt, I don't think, in the minds of most prosecutors that that's where it is. What prevents the states from delegating in the name of uniformity, whatever, the authority that they have to the federal government, specifically to the president, who might be able to, and if there is no prohibition on that, the second part of the question, if there's no prohibition on that, couldn't the president, under the same theory, assert that there are exigent circumstances that require that he take this action, whether he has the specific delegation of authority from the governors or not? And then the third part of that question is, if he does assert, and putting aside whether the courts would try to stop him or could stop him, how long would the exigency continue? In the case of a pandemic, would it be until there's a vaccine? Would it be until, you know, there's been a herd immunization? What would be the mechanism for determining that the exigency has disappeared?
So I have a very hard time imagining people like Governor J.B. Pritzker giving any kind of authority to the president at all. And I just don't see any governors doing it. I mean, to the extent to which you're going to have a friendly governor, they're going to follow whatever advice the president gives because they have a good relationship. But other than that, I don't see that happening. And with respect to your exigent circumstances question, Joe, I don't think so. I mean, I think that if you had clearly, if there was a rebellion going on, the Constitution gives the president authority. I think he would certainly have authority if there was an imminent foreign invasion coming. There are OLC opinions, as John well knows, that sort of cover those circumstances. But I think if he just sat there and said, there's an exigent circumstances, and therefore I'm going to declare essentially dictatorial powers, I don't think that would get very far.
Thanks for calling. I really hope you're suffering out there in Arizona, where it sounds like you can drive around and do things still. You were wise to escape the lockdown when you did from San Francisco. Yeah, I think I can't walk 10 feet out of my house without being arrested out here. Without a pass from the Federal Society to participate in media activities, which do receive a First Amendment exception. So I agree with that. I think, Joe, actually, your experience as a U.S. attorney here would be helpful because, one of the things that you could see happening, rather than the state directly delegating power to the federal government in this emergency, you could see the states intensively cooperating with the federal government. There's some joint terrorism task forces, the other task forces, you as U.S. attorney here working on drugs and so on. I think that would be the model where state and federal enforcement coordinated so that they're, complementary powers would be well matched. And as you know, it's really the state police and officials that really have all the on-the-ground information. And so any kind of real effort by the federal government to come in with control would still require voluntary cooperation by state officials. But I think your experience would be, I think, more important than a lot of other federal government officers and how to actually do that.
You actually raised one other point, John, that's a good one, which is that if the president were to try to do that, there's no way there are enough federal officials in order to this. Couldn't use the military because it's posse comitatus laws. And there's certainly not enough federal officials to do this. He would have to dragoon state authorities to cooperate. And he can't do that because it would violate anti-commandeering principles. I just don't think he could do it without the cooperation of the states.
Well, you could federalize the National Guard. I mean, there are a lot of things that you could do in certain
aspects. I was just going to mention.
We know when tornadoes end. We know when tornadoes end, and we know when, floods abate and all that sort of thing. But with a pandemic, we really don't know what the end is or when the end will be. And, the president has asserted, I have the power. I mean, I can do these things when, in fact, he probably can't. But if he faced a recalcitrant group of governors, for whatever reason, political motives or otherwise, and made the argument that, look, you easily could have cooperated with me. We could have done all of this together. But that suggests that you would be giving me the lead on this. And since you didn't decide to do that, I can, because of the exigency of the circumstance, I can assume that power for the duration. Now, it'll take time for a court to make the decision that it was improper for me to do that. But as in the case of Herman, by the time they got around to criticizing him and rebuking him, the crisis had passed. So
I don't think so. I think you could use the carrots and sticks that we talked about before, but I don't think you could go in there and say, you know, I have absolute power and just do that. I think you'd be shut down pretty quickly.
I think it requires much worse circumstances. I mean, there is some power to do that, but the circumstances would have to be much worse than what we're facing now. You know, as you saw in California with the breakdown of law and order after the Rodney King verdict.
Yes. If you had a rebellion.
Some kind of, Or just breakdown of law and order.
That's right. If state authorities cannot enforce law, then it's got authority. But that's what it would take, I think.
Let's try and get to a final question. I wonder about that language about foreign invasion, you know, if there's an allegation and maybe even some level of proof that this was an engineered virus or in the future going forward, an invasion, a technology invasion of a computer virus that's not feet on the ground but comes within our borders. But maybe that's for another call. Let's see if we can squeeze in a final question here. Go ahead, caller from area code 917.
Yes, hello, Josh Jackson here. And I think from my perspective, I'm seeing this more through the lens of just public health law in general on a sort of common good for the state itself and that separation through federalism and the like. So to take on as a president or the executive branch at a federal level, the liability within the states, I think doesn't help the argument in terms of, oh, I'm just going to take it on. It's my responsibility, when it would hurt individuals, across the states and all of them. Does that make sense?
I'm not quite sure what it is you're asking. If you're asking about liability for people who are, say, open up businesses and comply with federal regulations, I mean, so that's sort of the flip side of what John was talking about in terms of Congress's commerce clause power. I mean, you one of them is to say you can't do something, the other is, you know, granting them liability. And that is being discussed now. And I think that Congress probably could do this because of the effect on interstate commerce of, you know, these businesses either opening up or being reluctant to open up. But we will see what Congress does with that, and we'll see. Now, I don't know if that's getting to your question.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting to my question in terms of, you know, keeping it in the states, I think, is the lens that we all need to look through this from. And I think Congress would not push to move it out of the states. And the only way that they would think about doing that is if it went against the common good of the country, rather than looking at it from, let's say, individual rights sort of standpoint.
I get it. I think it's pretty straightforward. I think if you look at the statutes that John and I are talking about, they actually are very respectful and maybe even reinforce federalism rather than trying to run against it. And they do recognize states are the primary regulators and sort of the ground troops on any public health issue, and to provide a more supporting role with money and finances and equipment and expertise rather than trying to displace it. So I quite agree with that. And we look like we've run out of time, unfortunately. But go ahead, John, last word.
The last point is that even on that same thing, even the regulation that we're talking about communicable diseases has another provision, subsection E, that preserves federalism. It basically says if the Secretary of HHS does not invoke this authority, there is no preemption, and federal, state, and local officials can do what they think they need to do to address communicable diseases. So I think cooperative federalism has worked pretty well. A lot of these statutes recognize that, but again, difficult times test these limits.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. We've got questions on the board remaining, but that just points up the fact that we'll need to revisit the John and John show sooner rather than later. My thanks to you both from joining us from your undisclosed locations. Thanks as well to the audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions as we continue our Executive Branch Review Week. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.